This is the Leading Saints podcast. With the new name of our organization, we are going big. How are we going big? With a huge leadership conference happening November 27th in Salt Lake City, Utah. Now don't worry, if you don't live in Utah, it will be broadcast completely online for the world to see. This event will transform your ward council as you hear from Steve Schallenberger, Scott Robley, and even one of our most popular guests in the history of the podcast, Deanna Murphy. This is going to be a transformational event as thousands of members of ward councils gather in Salt Lake City or gather around their computer and apply leadership principles that will move your leadership to the next level. See all the details and get your entire ward council registered for free at leadingsaints.org.
Hello, this is Brian Hughes from the Hingham, Massachusetts stake just outside of Boston. I was first introduced to Leading LDS in 2016 by a colleague from work. I was initially skeptical as I had previously looked, but had not found quality leadership material outside of official church sources that was not in some way biased or otherwise antagonistic against particular church teachings. Upon listening, I found the Leading LDS podcast to be in alignment with church doctrine and teachings, while still honest about the realities found in the local wards and branches, such as the conflict between our typical culture and tradition compared to the true teaching and spirit of the doctrine. At that time in my life, I spent considerable amount of time driving for my responsibilities and found myself listening through most of the past episodes. Not only did this help me gain additional understanding of my own role, but also insight in how I can better work with others. Having served in many leadership positions, I very much appreciated listening to the How I Lead segments where sisters were interviewed. This helped me to gain more empathy and to better understand how I could support these hardworking sisters. I should also mention that the Leading LDS podcast associated with same-sex attraction, faith transitions, addiction recovery, early return missionaries, and other difficult topics were well done and exemplified the love our Heavenly Father has for each of us and how we as leaders can show love and compassion to each of His sons and daughters. I've been a strong advocate of Leading LDS in gospel settings, and I've regularly shared links to episodes generally, as well as to specific individuals where I felt inspired that it might help. As a family, we have found value in the podcast as my wife serves as the stake young women's president, my son was recently called as elders quorum president in a single adult branch. Additionally, I also found that nearly every episode applies to my professional life in some way, as I have been working to include the Savior in all aspects of my life and not just my family and spiritual life. I've been blessed to have the Spirit help me make connections between gospel teachings and professional application. The wide variety of experiences and personalities in the Leading LDS podcast help me to relate to a wider group of people and ultimately to be a better leader inside and outside of the church.
Hey, welcome back to another episode of the Leading LDS podcast. And I hopefully by the time that this is posted, we've announced our new name. But for us, it's not as easy as running to a Facebook page and changing that name. So I appreciate your patience. We are moving beyond the LDS, and we have great things in store. So my name is Kurt Frankham, and I'll be your host. And I'm really excited to have you listen to this episode because it is an episode where I interview one of the members of our board. As a nonprofit, you're required to have a board that makes the decisions of all things related to that nonprofit. And Rebecca Pito is one of those board members, and she has been so invaluable during our journey of creating Leading LDS and knowing the direction to go. She has a strong background in fundraising, in philanthropy, and in all things related to nonprofits. And so to be able to pick up the phone and call her and say, okay, Rebecca, I'm thinking about doing this. What do you think? And she says, good idea or bad idea, or maybe consider doing this. And so a lot of our growth as a nonprofit, a lot of the credit goes to her. And whether I know she would totally deny that, but it's true. And I've really appreciated her as a mentor. And the other thing about her is that she's a Relief Society president in Pennsylvania. And so I thought, well, for sure, we've got to do a How I Lead episode with you, Rebecca, to hear about your experience leading. And this is her third time being a Relief Society president, two times before in YSA wards. And she brings so much leadership thought and knowledge, and she is the epitome of a latter-day woman leader in this gospel. And I'm so excited for you to hear it and learn from her. Something to consider, and I'll mention this maybe at the end, is to share this with a Relief Society president you know, because Rebecca's perspective will bring so much value to them, and I know that it will give them perspectives that they haven't considered before. So I'm excited for you to meet Rebecca. Here is my interview with Rebecca Pito. Today, I have the opportunity to sit down with Rebecca Buxton Pito. How are you, Rebecca?
Doing great.
Awesome. Now, I am just ecstatic to have you on the podcast because you are a member of the leading LDS, or whatever we decide to call this thing, the leading LDS board of directors. And I'm proud to say we have women represented on that board of directors, and you fill that role for now.
Absolutely.
And maybe let's talk about, just for the audience, how that came to be before we jump into your background and your calling. And, but I guess a good place to start is your professional background. So what do individuals need to know about what you bring to the board of directors of leading LDS?
Sure. So I am a nonprofit fundraiser. I started my profession right after my undergraduate degree and was a fundraiser in the performing arts, and have since built a career fundraising in a small social service nonprofit, now in a healthcare organization, and I'm just really excited about finding ways to leverage resources in our community to help serve missions that I am passionate about.
And you are based out in Pennsylvania area?
Right? Yeah.
Philadelphia area in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, I've been in Philadelphia for 2 years, but our paths did cross, Kurt, back in Salt Lake City when I lived there for 4 years and was best friends and still am with your sister-in-law. So.
That's right. That's how we first met, is Nicole, my sister-in-law, is, I mean, you guys are BFFs. I mean, quite literally. If friends could get sealed, you two would be first in line.
That's right. Friendship, friendship in our world is important. But I heard about what you were doing, you know, long before I joined the cause. It was when I was in graduate school and I was getting a degree in philanthropic studies that, Kurt, you happened to be in Indianapolis where I was in school and picked my brain. And I thought that was really fun. And I think I like what he's doing. And I think he listened to my feedback, and it's always fun to be listened to. So I decided I wanted to get more involved. And I think you invited me to become more involved. And it took me a little while, but I've really appreciated the chance to be a part of this. I think it's really needed. And, you know, in my service in the church, we can get into that later, but living in Salt Lake and Indianapolis, now in Philadelphia as an adult in all three places, I've just seen the various needs, the leadership, support, mentorship, feedback that we all need as we serve in the church, in this now worldwide church. And I think what you're offering is really important.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with you. And I want the audience to realize that Rebecca has played a crucial role on the board of directors. That, you know, we've had long conversations over the phone, just me saying, okay, here's my plan. This is what I want to do. And you'd say, good idea, but maybe tweak it here, there, and also there. And then we've gotten a better value and product out of it that's hopefully served the greater leading LDS audience in doing that. So Rebecca, you are the brains of this operation.
Oh, sure. Whatever. I love helping with the fundraising. I want to support. You're the creator, the founder, and you have all the great original ideas. I just like kind of melding your message to help support what you're doing.
Awesome. Well, great. Let's jump into your general background as far as not just a awesome philanthropist, or I guess what would be the term of what
well,
you do at?
Philanthropy is very important to me. So I consider myself a philanthropist. When I married my husband a year ago, we created a philanthropy budget, initially to his chagrin, but now he enthusiastically encourages me to take the little extra scrapings each month from our budget toward my philanthropy fund. So that's important to me. But
nice. And this is a great example for those listening. Every couple should have a philanthropy budget and give everything. I mean,
sometimes it goes elsewhere, Kurt, but you are at the top of the list. So,
nice.
Yes.
Yeah, nice. So where was it that you were raised?
I grew up in Pennsylvania, so I've kind of come full circle. So my parents moved around when I was younger, but by the time I was in kindergarten, we lived in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, and that's where I grew up all the way through high school. That's where I was raised in the church and established all of my interests.
And you talked about in the notes I had you prepare for this interview, you talked about being raised and nurtured in a home that built confidence and strength. And this stood out to me, especially, you know, because I have a daughter, as you know, that, and I want to raise her with confidence and strength. So expound on that. What did that look like in your time being raised?
Yeah, you know, I think about this a lot. I'm not a mother yet, but I hope to be. And I think about, what is it that my parents did that really gave me this sense of deep confidence, you know, and an ability to endure and work hard. They really instilled those values in me. And I think, first of all, my parents, we grew up working hard in our family. My parents weren't oppressive, but they had expectations of me and my siblings. We all were expected to contribute to our home and to play a role in our home. And I think sometimes I observe other people and their parenting styles, and I'm not an expert in that area at all. That's not what I know, but I try to watch those things. And I think that when I was growing up, my parents, I trusted them so much and they were so consistent in their expectations of me that it didn't even cross my mind that I would just be lazy. You know, we worked hard and that's what we did in our family. And especially the confidence piece, my parents, as we grew up, especially kind of incrementally, like, you know, by the time I was in high school, especially, they sat with us carefully and helped us make decisions, but they really empowered us as children to make our own decisions. I think back to decisions about whether I should pursue a certain club in high school, whether I should add a job to my schedule, a part-time job to save money for a car, if I should participate in basketball, if that was a worthwhile effort for me. And those decisions really rested on my shoulders. My parents were willing to be a listening ear and to teach me the principles that they thought I should consider as I made those decisions. But they expected me to kneel in prayer and make those decisions myself.
So how did they support you in those decisions when probably in the back of their mind, they disagreed with it? They thought it wouldn't be best for them.
Yeah, I think there were many decisions I made growing up that my parents wouldn't have been their first choice. They trusted me. I think I say that they instilled hard work and expectations, but they also really trusted us. One example, this was later in my childhood, but when I chose to go to college, I know that my parents were a little concerned about the choice I made, but they watched me make the decision and they encouraged me to make pros and cons lists and to consider the decision really carefully and then take it to the Lord. And they knew that I had gone through a process that they asked me to follow. And so they trusted me. They didn't doubt me and they didn't discourage me. My mom tells me a story of when she took me to college. This was a state school. There had been a drug bust in our dormitory the first day when they dropped me off. And my mom thought, she's just left me in this place. She was so worried about me. And she talks about driving home in the car and just bawling her eyes out, thinking she couldn't believe that she'd just done that and that she'd allowed me to make that decision. But the experiences I had in college were just very perfectly catered to me and me personally, my needs as an individual. And my parents and I have actually talked now as that's in the past about how happy they are that I made that decision and they allowed me to make that decision because they are confident it was the right path for me. So.
And it makes me wonder, you know, you mentioned confidence, that they sort of instilled confidence in you as they were raising you. And when you do that and then allow your children to make decisions, even if they're bad decisions, I think that confidence will at some point take over and lead that us as individuals in the right way, right? Because we're not timid in anything and we're willing to move forward and step through obstacles as they come.
Yeah. And I think we might get into this later, but when I say confidence, of course, I don't mean a certain personality trait. You know, just because you're loud or you are forthcoming with your opinion, it doesn't mean you're confident. I think it's a sense of confidence, you know, internally, who you are and what you believe in. And I think the other thing that's important for us as we are parents or as we prepare to be parents that I saw in my parents is they both had an inner confidence in who they were and what their purpose was and their role was in our family and as parents to me. And so I think that confidence just, you know, osmosis or whatever you want to call it, I just soaked it in through them.
Yeah. And that kind of segues to my next topic that I want to talk about. But is there anything else as far as your being raised, the nurturing you received that would be beneficial to mention?
Oh, you know, I've listened to several of your podcasts, Kurt, and people have come from all over the world and that you've spoken with. I think my experience growing up in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, you know, was unique, like many of our experiences are in the church. You know, we were in a small congregation. Most of the people in our congregation were what we could call first generation members of the church. So they weren't steeped in church culture. They weren't steeped in perceived notions of what Relief Society activities look like or what a good bishop wears or how he behaves. And I think that really gave me a fresh look at the gospel and at the church, that sometimes maybe people who've been in the church for a long time, they start, I don't know what the theory would be called, but you know, we kind of flock, we follow patterns, we follow what we see other people doing. And because I was in a ward where people were new to the church, I think there was more authenticity in how people lived the gospel and how they served in our ward. And that was a huge blessing, I think, in my life, and really was important in how I developed how I interact with the church and how I am authentic in what I do and how I lead, really.
Yeah. And so when you lived in Utah during the, a few years ago, when obviously you come to a place where we're swimming in culture and tradition, and, which is, I don't mean that as like a jab at this state where I'm raised, but how can we, what do you think? Like, how do you foster that in Utah when you're leading? Because I don't think any leader here wants to get trapped in that culture or tradition, but it's so like ever present, and it's sort of a battle when you do try and change something.
Yeah. So first of all, I just a disclaimer, I loved my 4 years in Utah, and I just really am the first to step up and defend Utah and being a member of the church in Utah and serving in wards in Utah. When anyone on the East Coast gets their nose up in the air and says, oh, well, in Utah, they just do it differently. So I loved living in Utah. But to answer your question, I'll tell you one experience, and I don't mean for this to be, I don't mean to emphasize the negative, but to give you a quick perspective. I was in West Virginia when I was in college. I went to West Virginia University. I was in a student ward with, I think there were about 150 active members in our ward. It was a great place for me to kind of develop in as my first place away from home. And then I came straight to Utah, and I lived in Salt Lake City, and I met wonderful people. But I remember my first Sunday in a singles ward. And I remember I wore, just a comfortable sweater and a skirt and some flat shoes or something. And I walked to church because it was just a couple blocks away. And I showed up, and I watched the people come into this church building in this singles ward. And I felt like I was like in Hollywood or something. It felt like people were walking down the red carpet. I mean, people were just dressed to the nines. And that was really new for me. I didn't grow up in a place where people were really over the top, formally dressed for church. We dressed in our best. We dressed well. But this was kind of like a showy element that I had never experienced before. So I think if we can try to, one thing that affected my initial experience in Utah was this focus on our external perception, the perception that people have of us, our appearance and how we present ourselves, the car we drive, those kind of things. I think there are a lot of reasons why it is this way in Utah, and they're not, some of it is just the nature of being in a place where there are more of us. But I think trying to, as much as we can, discourage the emphasis on our outward appearance or how we're perceived, when we come to church on Sunday or when we're spending time with people from our ward, I think we can all do a better job of just trying to be less, could I say, showy?
You can. That's allowed.
Yeah. So I don't mean for that to be negative, but that was my very first experience as a single member of the church in Utah.
Yeah. And I think there are many instances where, like you said, where there's this culture that's just obvious, especially in a singles ward. And sometimes it can be difficult to address because everybody sort of knows it's there, but nobody's really talking about it. And I think from a leadership standpoint, a lot of people ask me, well, what do you do with negative tradition or bad culture? You point at it and you talk about it. The more you talk about it, the more it subsides and leaves. And so, having a discussion, using your example in a YSA ward and just talking about how can we get rid of this feeling that you have to dress up for an Hollywood premiere every time you come to the church, how can we take that down a notch and just have this place be more welcoming and more relaxed and maybe to a level of casualness that's okay.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I don't mean to say we shouldn't, try to look our best, but I think one thing, I was often drawn to people who just seemed really authentic. We all have different styles. We all are attracted to different colors and different ways of presenting ourselves, those people who maybe didn't look like everyone else, to me, made me feel safer. So just being willing, if that kind of culture doesn't resonate with you, to reflect what is comfortable for you, that's a good move to indicate to other people, to signal to other people that they can do that as well.
Awesome. So I want to talk about, you mentioned in some of the notes you prepared, as far as your identity as a Latter-day Saint woman. And I think a lot of this comes from, like you mentioned, the nurturing you received as a young woman and as a child in your home. But also, you know, you didn't get married 2 years after high school and at BYU to the first boy you meet or anything like, not that that's overly typical, but, you know, Latter-day Saints are known for being married in their early 20s or whatever it is. But I'm curious, maybe starting there, like, how old were you? I'm trying to remember when you did get married and what did you learn about that YSA experience that maybe would appeal to YSA leaders that are listening?
Sure. So I was married when I was 29. I had lived in Utah for 4 years, and then I made a very daring move to go to Indianapolis away from all of the single LDS men and went to graduate school and came to Philadelphia. And about 6 months after I moved to Philadelphia, I met my husband, and it was a rapid romance from there. And it's been really great. So I think, you know, I've talked ad nauseum to my friends who are still single or who lived some of their singlehood with me, and about what can be frustrating about singles wards, or how we can treat single members differently to help empower them. One of my big takeaways when I was a single member of the church, especially in Utah, is that we have so many people who are willing to serve and support the young single adults, but sometimes it's like a continuation of the youth program, because the adults tend to step in and say that they'll help plan everything. You know, this is stereotypical, but this is a typical experience for me when I was a young single adult. The bishopric works with the ward to decide what the plan is going to be for an activity. And then the bishopric's wives provide all the food and help with the decorations. And they tell the sisters in the Relief Society, if they want to come help, they can show up and help. So instead of providing an opportunity for the single members of the ward to be true leaders in the ward, to really make the judgment calls and to really be the ones who have to do the work to make things happen, I think will help them be more invested as in their service in the church. I think we know from statistics that have come out from LDS members and non-LDS members that people who are single in the church are the ones who are most likely to lose. And a lot of times, maybe they're less committed to their callings, they're less engaged, but I wonder if that's because they feel less needed. So finding ways to make them feel needed and to empower them to be leaders in their ward, I think is really important.
So what would you say as far as, you know, just talking around this concept of your identity as a Latter-day Saint woman, what did that decade of, you know, the first decade of your adult life as a single Latter-day Saint woman, how did that add to your identity, or how did it adjust it, or what, in hindsight, how do you perceive your identity differently because of that experience?
Yeah, well, true transparency. I mean, since I've been married, I think all of our life we go through ebbs and flows, and our sense of understanding of how we fit into the big picture or how we feel like we will find our way. And as a single person, I feel like things really ebbed and flowed for me as well. You know, I think sometimes I felt really frustrated that I wasn't married and I didn't understand what I was doing wrong. And other times I felt really excited about all of the experiences I was having and all of the growth I was able to have as a single individual. So I think one thing that I learned as a single Latter-day Saint, well, as a single member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, I should say, how to truly embrace the now and embrace the opportunities that are immediately in front of me. There are so many things out of our control. You know, I just listened to a great BYU devotional. They were talking about, it was a woman who'd struggled with fertility, talking about her experience with infertility. So we're single and we wish that we could be married. We're married and we want to have kids and we wish that we could be fertile. You know, we have kids and we wish that we could have more money to pay for all of the things we want to pay for them. You know, there's always things that we wish for to have more of, or that we could have control over, but we don't truly have control over. So for me, in my personal experience and my kind of journey of faith, is finding a way to embrace what is, to have faith in the grace that we know is there through the Savior, that our lives will come together in a way that's more beautiful than we can imagine. And I can say, you know, emphatically, and this always makes me feel a little emotional, that, you know, I think about the many years that I was single, and some people are single much longer than me or their whole lives. But I think about the time from when I left high school, age 18, and dated and tried to find a companion for myself until I was 29. And I think about the times when I felt so discouraged and so frustrated with my lack of control to find what I wanted. And I look back at the arch of those time, that time in my life, and I see the beauty of the experience. And I also see that what I was looking for, what I wanted, what I found instead when I was 28 and married my husband when I was 29, he's better than I could have imagined. And our relationship is more fulfilling and more rewarding than I could have ever hoped for. And that's because of the experiences that I had leading up to that. So that's kind of, for me, that's kind of the idea, the grace idea that's there, that sometimes we have pain. Sometimes things aren't the way we want them to be, but we can have faith that through the grace of Jesus Christ, that all things will work together for our good, and that they can be come together in a beautiful way, better than we can imagine, whether in this life or in another time.
Yeah, I love that. And so in those moments, the tough days where you were looking for answers or trying to understand why, was there something, you know, habitual that you put into place, or was it just mainly just getting in the right state of mind? Or what did the application look like in those tough days?
You know, we all have different strengths and different ways of being motivated. I have taken the strengths finder. I think someone else you've interviewed has talked about strengths before. For me, one of my strengths, one of the things that I'm inclined towards, is I'm a futuristic person. And I also really disciplined. I like discipline. So I found something that fit really well for me by kind of exercising some visioning exercises. So I'll say in general, I turned to conference talks and especially BYU devotionals, where I could find some solace in truth and words of encouragement. And one time I found a BYU devotional, it's called Where There Is No Vision by Elder L. Tom Perry. And he talks about the importance of having a vision for your life. And because I'm such a futuristic person, that really resonated with me. And just with the blessing of some help from the Spirit, I recognized that I could take that talk and turn it into a worksheet, and that I could look at that worksheet and I could figure out, how can I get from where I want to be, from where I am, to where I'm going? And what does that look like? And there are a lot of things that we don't have control over. But when I did that exercise, I took his words. He said, ask yourself this, consider this. And I turned that into a worksheet. And every time I felt discouraged, I would go through that worksheet. And if it felt like they were still relevant, I would find peace in knowing that I was working towards my goals. And if it felt like things had shifted and I needed to change it, I would take that worksheet and I would fill it out again. And I would make sure that what I was doing resonated with where I wanted to be. And that kind of helped me feel like I was doing what I could to go in the direction that I wanted. So I think just finding like routines, patterns, things, whether it be writing in your journal or reviewing a worksheet or listening to a certain talk that really motivates you, just admitting, okay, this is a hard moment and I need to find some peace and I need to find some direction, and taking that time to do that, it's really important, instead of just wallowing or instead of kind of shoving it aside.
Wow. I love that answer for a variety of reasons. One, I think it's easy to say, you know, especially during hard times, to say, well, what you need to do is forget about yourself and go serve somebody, which I think is sound advice and has helped me a lot in my life. But I love this approach that you took, where you step back and you figured out what your strengths were. You know, you mentioned the strength finders, which is something we mentioned prior on Leading Yes, which has been awesome and something that everybody should look into. And really, I love this concept of by identifying your strengths. And again, it's not so you can find your strengths so that you can then run out and find your eternal spouse or solve the problem. But by focusing on your strengths, I think there's a lot of comfort, and it enables you to enable the grace of Jesus Christ, right?
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
Anything else in regards to that concept of that decade of your life?
I will say that I think we can each, it's important as we go through different phases in life to identify the things that bring us joy. And for me, one thing I learned about halfway through that period of mine is that I consider myself a feminist. I was very passionate about my career, and I felt like that's where I could find a lot of meaning and purpose. And that is true, and it remains true for me today, even as I'm married. But one thing that I finally realized about halfway through that period of time is that nurturing children brought me a lot of joy. And so I started to intentionally find ways to position myself in people's lives so that I could nurture their children. And there were so, when I made that decision and I prayed to have opportunities to nurture other people's children, there were many miracles that came into my life. I had the opportunity to serve a sister when I was in Indianapolis who was a working woman and her husband was in medical school and she had this sweet two-year-old. And because I was in graduate school and had a flexible schedule, I spent 3 hours with him 3 times a week. And I picked him up from daycare. I learned how to keep him happy for those 3 hours. I always met him with a cheese stick and some pretzels because I knew it'd calm him down to have some snacks that he was used to having when I showed up and I wasn't his mom. And it was really, it was just a rewarding 9 hours of my week to spend time with him. And it was, and this mother talked to me so much about how it was a huge blessing to her. She couldn't make it to daycare in time to pick him up. And so me going and picking him up helped her feel calm and confident that he was in good hands and that she was doing what she needed to as a mother to take care of him. And it was just really rewarding for me. So I think finding those things, understanding parts of our divine identity, that they don't have to just disappear because we're single. We still can nurture children as men or women, if that's what we want. We still can invest in relationships. That's, I guess that's the other thing I would add, is that I find great joy investing in any type of relationship. And when I wasn't married, you know, I found joy in investing in relationships like that, that I have with your sister-in-law, but with many others as well. And being willing to invest in other things, even though it may not be your eternal companion or your children, I think can be really rewarding.
Love that. Man, we could end the interview here and have a home run, but we're not going to do that. I want to talk about your experience now. You have recently been called as a Relief Society president. Tell us about your ward and what that experience has been like the last few months.
Yeah, can I just back up for a second? So this is by no means an effort to say, ooh, I've had all these callings, but just to give a little bit of context for how my experience is affecting me now or how it feels to me. I was a Relief Society president for many years in singles wards in 2 different times in my time as a single woman. And then when I was in my late 20s, I chose to go to a family ward instead of a single ward. I had the option to go to a single ward, singles ward, but because I wanted to be nurturing children, I went to a family ward. And gosh darn it, they gave me a calling in Relief Society instead of in primary. And so there I was in the Relief Society presidency again. And so coming into the Relief Society presidency here in Philadelphia, I've kind of brought good things and some baggage, like fears or concerns about what it's going to be like. And so one thing I'd say about the experience it's been for me so far is serving here in Philadelphia, I've had to really examine some of my self-talk, some of my fears, some of my past experiences to make sure that I fully embrace this opportunity to be a leader in my ward. And I don't approach the elders quorum president with preconceived notions that our relationship is going to be the same as the last time or whatever it is, that I make sure that I give it a real fresh start. So I think sometimes we as members of the church cycle through callings, right? And because I was single, I didn't, most of my adult life, I was in singles wards. So there are only so many places I could serve. So I served in Relief Society a lot. So trying to approach this time, this calling, with the experiences that I've had in the past, the strengths that that gives me, but then being willing also to have an open mind about this being a different experience and me trying to leverage different things about myself has been really important.
Yeah, I like that concept of, I think we do that a lot because we do sometimes cycle through different callings or we've had callings that we had once before. And it's easy to think, oh, I remember the last time was a nightmare working with that elders quorum president. And so we sort of project that on the new elders quorum president. You may think like, wow, like, why is she so hard to work with? I mean,
that was like the easiest example for me to give. I actually have never had a bad experience with an elders quorum president, full disclosure. That's just an easy example.
Okay.
Yeah, for sure. But I think it's helpful, you know, as you're put in a new calling to sort of analyze what self-talk or baggage am I bringing to this experience that I had before? And how can I like work that out of my system and start anew, right?
Yeah. And also we know this, every individual is different and every ward consists of individuals. So every ward is very different. So we can bring our experiences, but we really need to have an open mind and understand that every situation we step into, I mean, for those of us who move a lot or for those of us who see wards changing and stay in the same ward, and we need to be open-minded about serving the individuals and recognizing the unique situations in our ward.
So how would you describe your current ward, the demographics and any unique characteristics?
Yeah, I think I told you, I feel like our ward is unique, but I think there are a lot of wards like this in the church. And some of the changes I've seen coming in the church, just administrative, logistical changes in the church, to me it feels great because it feels like our leaders in the church are listening and paying attention to what's happening in our growing church. So my ward is in Philadelphia. It's in Philadelphia city limits. And we are in the Philadelphia stake. There are quite a few wards in our stake. We are one of the wards that's more considered, I guess, a demographic. Some people would call it like an inner city ward. And we have a great diversity in our ward. Again, majority of the people in our ward are first generation members of the church. So these are people who haven't had experiences in primary, for example. I mean, their children are now having experiences in primary, but the adults who are serving, they don't know primary songs. They maybe don't have preconceived notions about, let's see, like what ward activities you should have every year, or they don't even know. You know, my bishop mentioned the other day, I saw a little card on his desk, and it was instructions as to how to administer blessing. And we have so many wonderful Melchizedek priesthood holders in our ward. The majority of them are still learning what it means to give a blessing. So in our ward, we have immigrants from African countries. Philadelphia has a strong immigrant population refugee, from Liberia. And then we also have many people, these are first and second generation families, I would say, in the church from South America. Most of the people in our ward who are from South America, they joined the church when they came to Philadelphia, but now have strong families in the church in the Philadelphia area. And then we do have some Caucasian members of the ward. And one thing that's unique in this ward, and I actually experienced in Indianapolis as well, is we do have people from our stake who serve in wards that maybe have more experienced leaders that can fulfill callings in their wards. They have been assigned by the stake. It's like, it's not a calling, it's an opportunity. The stake president offers the opportunity for you to accept an assignment to serve in the ward that you don't live in the boundaries for. So we have people in our ward who maybe do have a little more leadership experience in the church and can hopefully mentor some of the newer members of the church in our ward who maybe live, instead of only within the 20 or 30 minutes of our ward boundaries, live 45 minutes to an hour away. And they commit to spend 1 year serving in our ward to try to help strengthen the leadership in the ward.
So I remember my last stake, there was a branch, mm-hmm. You know, this was in Woods Cross area, and there was this branch and surrounded by a bunch of strong wards. And so they would send people there. So is it a particular ward that needs the help, or is it a two or three wards in the stake that the stake president may pick and choose which ward to place you in?
You know what? I'll tell you, honestly, I don't know if there are other wards in our stake that have people assigned. The assignment from the stake president is specific. So I don't know the process they go through to identify this, but I'm confident that there was some, you know, personal revelation involved for the stake president in choosing people who will serve in our ward. And this is a little caveat, not to get too sidetracked, but actually my husband and I were assigned to this ward. So we did not live in the ward boundaries for this ward. We were just married. We were in a great ward. Wonderful families in the ward. We were warmly welcomed. And about 2 months after we were in that ward, we were in a suburb of Philadelphia. We got a call from the stake president and he invited us to come to his home. And he said, I really have felt impressed to invite you to attend the Pennypack ward, which is the ward we're now in. And this speaks to how the Lord has a hand in all of our individual lives about 4 months after we were assigned to be in that ward and accepted the assignment, we found a home in those ward boundaries. And we weren't intentionally looking for a home in those ward boundaries, but it was our best option. And we really feel like we were meant to be in this ward, and that maybe the housing situation just wasn't quite in line with the Lord's timing, and he let the stake president know. So we ended up in the ward at the time we were meant to be there. So, yeah.
That's great. So it sounds like now that the call of Relief Society president has come, and you deserve it, it sounds like.
Deserve it. Yeah, sure.
That's interesting. So now that this was prior a ward that you were assigned to, but now you
are
living there. So, which makes a move a lot easier when you.
Yeah, it was great.
So you talk about this concept that you've identified in your leadership about being patient with others and allowing them to be who they are and recognizing who you are. What does that look like? Or how could you better articulate that leadership principle in your life?
Sure. So I think I sort of set this up by explaining that for me, it's really important that I can be authentic. I think, you know, I said that I was raised in a home where I really was nurtured to be very confident and strong as an individual. I try not to be too loud about it, but that is a part of who I am. And I think sometimes there are preconceived notions about how men behave in church, how women behave in church, or how we all behave in church, how we present ourselves, just the level of enthusiasm we have, or what kind of voice we use when we're giving a talk. You know, people tease about things like that sometimes, the prayer voice, right? Sister missionary voice, those kind of things. So for me, something that I've wrestled with and really feel like I've found my stride in being truly authentic to who I am, not pushing my personality on other people, but not trying to be the same as like my stake Relief Society president. I can be my own Relief Society president, and I can be authentic to myself. So I think along with that, as we are willing to do that for ourselves, we absolutely have to be willing to give that to other people. So I don't know, maybe someone's a little bit goofy and they have a funny sense of humor. Don't roll your eyes at them and always get annoyed with what they bring to the table. Let them bring their personality to the table. Allow them to feel comfortable being themselves. I don't know if that makes sense, but I think that's important. I will say one thing, again, not to be negative, but I'll give like an opposite example of that. So the bishop in my current ward is very, very supportive of me as a Relief Society president and really wants me to succeed and wants to respect me, I believe truly. But I think he sees my personality. Now, mind you, I've never raised my voice at him. I've never been, you know, incredibly forceful. I've just been myself, okay? But he has this funny thing that he likes to pretend like I'm kind of scary. So when I'm walking down the hallway, he'll like chatter his teeth and put his hands up like he's scared about what's going to happen next. And I think he thinks he's like showing that I'm really tough or something, like it's a compliment, but really it just makes me feel like insecure. Like, how am I behaving? Am I putting off a dynamic that makes him feel like I'm just like a tyrant, you know? So I think embracing people as they are, but also not trying to make them feel out of place. You know, there's a balance there. So I don't know if that makes sense, but that's been my experience.
Yeah. Well, Rebecca, I've known you for a long time, and I don't know how to say this. But okay, no, I'm just kidding. I kid. When you highlight the importance of adapting to needs of your ward, how does that reflect in your leadership?
I think stringing through all of this conversation, this is such a buzzword, but I'm just going to say it, is the concept of authenticity, right? We have ways that we do things in the church. And I believe one of the leadership principles I told you I really believe in is order and consistency. And I believe in laying a groundwork of order and consistency. But once those things are in place, we have so much flexibility in the church. We have flexibility as individuals. We also have a lot of flexibility as leaders, right? So we can be true to ourselves as individuals. We can also be true to our instincts, and we can reflect the needs of the individuals in our wards and how we fulfill our calling. So, for example, how a Relief Society president serves in a ward where there are a lot of young mothers, how they plan their Relief Society meetings, their weekday Relief Society meetings, how they help their sisters prepare and go to the temple. that will look very different than what it looks like in my ward, where many of the women in my ward are elderly, are single mothers, or are working single women. So that dynamic is going to be different. And we should never try to compare ourselves or try to emulate things that just aren't relevant to what we're doing.
I like that. And so, going to these buzzwords.
Authenticity, sorry.
This is good. I think this is a good discussion, because a lot of times there's this, you know, it's a doctrine that part of our role, our purpose here on this earth is to become sanctified and become more like our Father in heaven. And sometimes I can spill over into diminishing this authenticity concept because, well, no. There is a certain way that we're supposed to be in the eternities. And today it starts by how we dress in church, or today it starts by doing this, right? So I wonder how much that doctrine sort of reaches beyond the
ones
intended to be, that it's okay to embrace authenticity and embrace a ward that is unique and allow it to be authentic to what it is, rather than just sort of pushing it into the Latter-day Saint mold.
Yeah, you know what? We just talked in Sunday school this week about Christ-like attributes. And we talked about one of the things we talked about is humility. And actually, I teach the youth Sunday school in our ward too. And we talked, I remember I went a couple months ago, I went to the gym and there was a saying on the wall, I'm trying to remember what it says. It says, "We love what you see," or something like that. And it was trying to encourage like self-love, right? And we talked about that concept in our Sunday school class and talked about the difference between being authentic and really loving ourselves or embracing the differences around us and being humble and willing to change and willing to submit to the will of the Lord, right? So I'm trying not to take too far of a step back, but I think as a part of this conversation, we should always approach our authenticity with humility. And part of that, as we are humble in our callings, as we approach trying to be authentic, both ourselves and in how we serve others, we have to approach that with humility and willingness to not assume that our ideas are the only right ideas or our perception is the only perception. Does that make sense? And so I think approaching this idea of authenticity with humility is really important. And what I found, it's only been a couple weeks since I've been called to be a Relief Society president, but I think it's really important to be, as a way of being a humble leader, to be transparent, to be approachable, to not be condescending ever, to really lift those around us up instead of holding yourself above others. So as we kind of emulate authenticity in hand with humble service, humble willingness to serve, then we can see what's really needed, I think, if that makes sense.
Yeah. The verbiage that comes into my brain as we talk about this is that, you know, because I can see some people that society, the world sort of uses this authenticity buzzword in a way that, you know, some pop song or pop song you're seeing, "I was born this way."
Right? Yes.
You should accept it because this is my authentic self, right? But at the same time, I look at that and I say, no, like I was born this way so that I could become greater. But in the church context, in the Latter-day Saint context, I think it's important for us as leaders to step back and embrace the authenticity of everybody's journey. That they're on a different path back to maybe the same or a similar ideal, right, in the eternities. But the fact that they're on this authentic route, headed in a similar direction, that's, I think, what we can embrace, right?
Yeah. And I just went, I think I just was on a visit to see a sister in our ward with one of the other sisters in my Relief Society presidency. And what I walked away feeling is, wow, you know, I don't know any of the answers in her life, but I can love her, I can listen, and I can encourage her in the direction that she sees herself going, if that makes sense. So I think sometimes we try to lead those that we are serving by fitting them into a line, you know, getting them all in line and pushing them all in one direction. And we really can't do that successfully. We'll just feel like we're beating our heads against the wall if we try to do that. We really have to meet everyone where they are and acknowledge that they're on their own journey. And it's really important, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think by doing that, we get away from the fix it mentality as a leader that, oh, I'm supposed to, you know, there's a Johnny, the new convert, you know, I should really sit him down and tell him the importance of wearing a white shirt and stop wearing those baggy cargo shorts to church. You know, I should really, which I mean, sure, there may be moments when that is a helpful conversation, but mm-hmm. sometimes it's easy in leadership to sort of get in this mentality of like, okay, I got to talk to you about that because that's not gonna roll here. We got to fix that.
Yeah. So to further that concept a little bit, we were just in ward council last week and we talked about having a fast as ward leaders for the members of our ward. And the initial idea was to fast for the members of our ward to have the Lord's Spirit with them more and to be purified and to be more willing to serve, because we've had some issues with kind of some tension and a lack of willingness to serve from some people in our ward. And I just felt really strongly, and people were very supportive of this as I brought it up and as we discussed it as a group, that the approach for us as leaders isn't to pray for our ward members to do better. The approach as us as leaders is to pray to see how we can help our ward members feel able to be better and how we can inspire them, how we can lift them, what we as leaders can do better instead of trying to make others better, right? And so just that we're doing it right and we're teaching you that hierarchical kind of idea, we're really being shown, I think, in the way that Sunday school lessons are being taught and the way that new leadership manuals are being prepared. We're really being taught from the leaders of our church that that's not the way to serve. That's not the way of the church. So,
yeah, love that. I think this is a fantastic discussion. And so I'm curious, on the other side of the coin, you mentioned that you highly value order and consistency. So what does that look like in your day-to-day, week-to-week service?
I do highly value order and consistency. And I've always valued it, but it's really become a mantra for me in this ward, because in this ward especially, I gave you the context of sort of the dynamics we're working with or the variety of people's lives experiences that come to our ward. We have the majority of the people in our ward are living in a way that is very, it's not stable. They are very insecure, lots of insecurities, whether they be financial, emotional, whatever it is. There's a lack of stability in their lives. And so I think what we can offer in the ward, the way that we can help them progress spiritually is by providing a foundation of order and consistency in how we provide the gospel to them, how we help them serve, because there's not that order in so many other parts of their lives and really to no fault of their own. And we can help them find that order in the church, and maybe then they can take that order to other parts of their lives too, which we know is an eternal principle for becoming more like our Heavenly Father.
I love that, especially as a former inner city bishop.
Yeah.
I can totally resonate with that, that a lot of these people, their life can be so hectic and they don't know what the next hour looks like.
Yeah.
You know? And so by them knowing that, you know, when I walk in those doors on Sunday, I know what I'm going to expect, and giving them that structure and that consistency is so valuable for them in wanting to come back again and again.
And here we are again, right? Not just giving it to them, but letting them be a part of it, right? Like expecting them to be a part of that order as well, instead of us just providing it for them. And the other thing I would say, you've been in an inner city ward before, and I'm sure this isn't unique only to inner city wards, but since we're talking about it from that context, I think as leaders, you know, I've seen in my ward in Indianapolis, I saw this, and in my ward in Philadelphia, I've seen it. We can't do enough to help everyone. There's just not enough time in the day to create order in everyone's lives all the time. We can't do that much. And so one thing I think that we struggle with is where to put our energy. And what our Relief Society presidency has prayerfully considered and really believe is that, yes, we need to serve the individual. You know, the gospel is about the individual, but sometimes we may have to choose to have that individual wait for a day and make sure that we have something else arranged and in order for before we do that, if that makes sense. So for us, we have decided that the order is, it has to be there for us to be able to do the other things. And sometimes, not always, but sometimes it will have to trump, you know, that visit to someone's home. Of course, with the caveat of always listening to the Spirit and knowing what you should do, but...
Absolutely. Man, this is so true. And because part of that order and consistency, especially in an inner city ward, and again, it can be found in most wards, is creating boundaries, mm-hmm. right? Because if you don't create boundaries as a leader, these certain people with certain backgrounds that maybe aren't as consistent, they can really just bowl you over and demand a lot of your time. And one example of this in my ward as a bishop, I had a strong standing rule that we don't clean houses, because a lot of these individuals would, you know, they would be, you know, their life was hectic. They were in a certain, and maybe in a lower class stage in their life. And part of the hecticness of their life would be that they would have a messy house. And so they would turn to the Relief Society president or their visiting teachers, and they'd say, can you come clean, help me clean my house? And I would just always say, we do not clean houses. They will need to rely on their family to do that. And that created a firm boundary that allowed me to protect my leaders, not be overwhelmed by these constant requests that came from their life. So boundaries are crucial.
Yeah. And again, I think trying to go back to the concept of being authentic and reflecting what other people need, and also giving everyone the respect they need to really flourish. I think having boundaries ourselves gives other people the permission and the strength to have their own boundaries, right? So really, as we empower ourselves, we're giving others the opportunity to empower themselves too, themselves as well. I think if we let ourselves be walked all over, then people just, they walk all over you, and they're never progressing themselves and how they can handle that situation. So I think it's important. It's empowering them as well.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, as we wrap up here, anything we've missed, or is there anything else related to order and consistency that should be touched on, or any other principle that you want to make sure we mention before ending the interview?
You know, one thing I'll present to you, Kurt, as something I would love to be explored by you in an interview or just by other research that you do, is I'm finding as a Relief Society president, I listened to some of your other interviews recently, and I'm finding as a Relief Society president a difficult time kind of navigating how I work with the elders quorum and how I work with the bishop. Somehow for me, that's changed now that there's not a high priest group. That makes sense. So I think understanding, sometimes it feels a little bit like now that it's just the elders quorum, they're kind of like in charge and I kind of like report through them, and that feels weird. And so I think trying to make sure that while hierarchy isn't, we're not trying to be over others, but understanding kind of areas of command and making sure that we're all on the same page with that. I'm trying to work with my ward so that we all feel like we know what we own and where we can make decisions ourselves and where we need input as leaders, where I need to involve the elders quorum and the bishop, where I can make decisions just with my presidency.
Interesting.
I think when we come with a lack of experience in these things, sometimes we assume, I mean, I think a lot of times in wards, people run every little thing through the bishop, right? So I think sometimes we assume that there's an order of things that maybe isn't really in line with how it's really intended to be. So I think being thoughtful as leaders about that,
yeah,
and trying to make sure that we empower ourselves and empower others to have stewardship in their areas is important. I'd be curious for you to hear you talk a little more about that, since I love hearing your thoughts. So
yeah, that's an interesting concept, especially with structural changes as we've had that doesn't seem too, you know, huge. I mean, obviously we've just combined two groups of men, but that's one perspective I haven't considered, that yeah, maybe the elder quorum presidents out there are still trying to figure out where does my stewardship lie. And then even with this recent conference where, you know, the announcement that elders quorum is sort of absorbing the ward mission duties a little bit there, that it can suddenly, instead of having a elders quorum president and a Relief Society president, sounds like sometimes it feels like you have a bishop and then a bishop junior and then the Relief Society president, right? And really just discovering ways of how those relationships work together to reach success of the ward. Am I articulating that, what you're asking?
Yeah. And I think we, as we're in the middle of it, it's hard for us to really hash those things out. That's what I love about leading LDS, is you do a lot of that for us and give us some ideas and ways to deal with it. I don't know if I'll have the time to really hash it out, but if you present some ideas, it'll be easy for me to take that back to my bishop and really act on it. So thanks for what you do.
Yeah.
I'm giving you something else to do.
Yeah. And you do have some say around here. So I'm definitely listening. But I think that would be great. Maybe, you know, I do these WeWick episodes, What I Wish I Knew. Maybe we can talk about, just get a bunch of input from wards saying, how do you interact as a trio, the trio of the bishop, elders quorum president, and Relief Society president. I think that would
be cool.
All right. I have my assignment, Rebecca. I'll get to work and see what we can put together. So the final question I have, which I traditionally ask to all of our guests on the Leading LDS podcast, is as you reflect back on your time as a leader, especially, you know, this is your, I guess, third stint as a Relief Society president. How has being a leader made you a better follower of Jesus Christ?
I guess the two things I would say is that it's definitely been an opportunity to be humbled, to recognize my need for grace and for support from my Savior and from others around me. And second, it has helped me to truly love my Savior more deeply and to then love others more deeply through that love.
That concludes my interview with Rebecca Pito. Isn't she fantastic? Wonderful? Isn't it awesome that she is serving on the board of directors of Leading LDS, or whatever it is we're calling it? And please know, I mean, how awesome it is that she is there directing and helping me as the executive director of Leading LDS to know the next steps, things to consider, how to increase donations, how to fundraise so that we can fund the vast and broad mission that we have for this organization. And so, and not to even mention her experience as a Relief Society president, I learned so much from this discussion, and man, there's more to go, especially in the direction of that dynamic between Relief Society presidents and the bishop and the Elders Quorum presidents. I'll think on that. I'm not sure exactly how to present that type of topic or resources to reach out to, but if you have any ideas, I'd love to hear them. You can go to leadinglds.org/contact, and there, just send me an idea. Put your name and message in there, and it'll make it to my inbox so that we can consider how we can help more Relief Society presidents out there. And of course, a great way to help Relief Society presidents is, now that you've listened to this awesome interview, consider who you could forward it to and share it with in a simple email, on Facebook, however it is. That the word of mouth engine behind Leading LDS and in the Leading LDS community is by far the number one way that we reach a more vast audience. We, at the time of this recording, we reach as many as 55,000 individuals each month. And so by doing that, a lot of that growth comes from you as maybe a mother that has a daughter as a Relief Society president and saying, hey, you should listen to that. So please take some time today and share it. And don't forget to go to leadingsaints.org to register for the November 27th Leadership Conference.
It came as a result of the position of leadership which was imposed upon us by the God of heaven, who brought forth a restoration of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And when the declaration was made concerning the own and only true and living church upon the face of the earth, we were immediately put in a position of loneliness. The loneliness of leadership, from which we cannot shrink nor run away, and to which we must face up with boldness and courage and ability.